Good evening. Pelosi orders the House to impeach the president.
Today, I am asking our chairman to proceed with articles of impeachment.
And tear gas in Paris and what should be done to fix the opioid crisis. With these and other stories, I'm Paul DiRienzo with the WBAI News for Thursday, December 5th, 2019. Warning that American democracy is at stake, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi said today she's asked the House Judiciary Committee to draft articles of impeachment against President Donald Trump. It's a historic step that sets up a fight over whether to oust him from office.
Let us begin where our founders began in 1776, when in the course of human events, it becomes necessary for one people to dissolve the political bonds which have connected them with another. With those words, our founders courageously began our Declaration of Independence from an oppressive monarch, for among other grievances, the king's refusal to follow rightfully passed laws. In the course of today's events, it becomes necessary for us to address, among other grievances, the president's failure to faithfully execute the law. When crafting the Constitution, the founders feared the return of a monarchy in America. And having just fought a war of independence, they specifically feared the prospect of a king president corrupted by foreign influence. During the Constitutional Convention, James Madison, the architect of the Constitution, warned that a president might betray his trust to foreign powers, which might prove fatal to the Republic. Another founder, Governor Morris, feared that a president may be bribed by a greater interest to betray his trust. He emphasized that this magistrate is not the king. The people are the king. They therefore created a constitutional remedy to protect against a dangerous or corrupt leader, impeachment. Unless the Constitution contained an impeachment provision, one founder warned, a president might, quote, spare no effort or means whatsoever to get himself reelected. Similarly, George Mason insisted that a president who procured his appointment in his first instance through improper and corrupt acts might repeat his guilt and return to power. During the debate over impeachment at the Constitutional Convention, George Mason also asked, shall any man be above justice? Shall that man be above it who can commit the most extensive injustice? In his great wisdom, he knew that injustice committed by the president erodes the rule of law, the very idea that of fair justice, which is the bedrock of our democracy. And if we allow a president to be above the law, we do so surely at the peril of our republic. In America, no one is above the law. Over the past few weeks, through the Intelligence Committee working with the Foreign Affairs and Oversight Committees, the American people have heard the testimony of truly patriotic career public servants, distinguished diplomats, and decorated war heroes, some of the president's own appointees. The facts are uncontested. The president abused his power for his own personal political benefit at the expense of our national security, by withholding military aid and crucial Oval Office meeting in exchange for an announcement of an investigation into his political rival. Yesterday, the Judiciary Committee, the American people heard testimony from leading American constitutional scholars who illuminated without a doubt that the president's actions are a profound violation of the public trust. The president's actions have seriously violated the Constitution, especially when he says and acts upon the belief, Article 2 says I can do whatever I want. No, his wrongdoing strikes at the very heart of our Constitution, a separation of powers, three co-equal branches, each a check and balance on the other. A republic, if we can keep it, said Benjamin Franklin. Our democracy is what is at stake. The president leaves us no choice but to act because he is trying to corrupt once again the election for his own benefit. The president has engaged in abuse of power, undermining our national security and jeopardizing the integrity of our elections. His actions are in defiance of the vision of our founders and the oath of office that he takes to preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States. Sadly, but with confidence and humility, with allegiance to our founders and a heart full of love for America, today I am asking our chairman to proceed with articles of impeachment. I commend our committee chairs and our members for their somber approach to actions which I wish the president had not made necessary. In signing the Declaration of Independence, our founders invoked a firm reliance on divine providence. Democrats, too, are prayerful, and we will proceed in a manner worthy of our oath of office to support and defend the Constitution of the United States from all enemies, foreign and domestic. So help us God. Thank you.
At a news conference after her statement, Pelosi was asked if impeachment was being brought because of personal animosity towards Trump.
Do you hate the president, Madam Speaker? Representative Collins yesterday suggested that the Democrats are doing this simply because they don't like the guy.
I have nothing to do with that.
I think it's an important point.
I think the president is a coward when it comes to helping our kids who are afraid of gun violence. I think he is cruel when he doesn't deal with helping our dreamers, of which we're very proud. I think he's in denial about the climate crisis. However, that's about the election. This is about the election. Take it up in the election. This is about the Constitution of the United States and the facts that lead to the president's violation of his oath of office. And as a Catholic, I resent your using the word hate in a sentence that addresses me. I don't hate anyone. I was raised in a way that is full, a heart full of love, and always prayed for the president. And I still pray for the president. I pray for the president all the time. So don't mess with me when it comes to words like that.
But House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy was less than generous as he reluctantly said he'd give Pelosi the benefit of the doubt on her statement that Democrats don't hate Trump.
Mr. Leader, I gather you were watching just now when the Speaker, in rather effusive terms, denied that there is any personal animus on her part that is motivating impeachment drive. Representative Collins has suggested as much in the hearing yesterday when he intimated that the Democrats are simply impeaching President Trump because they don't like the guy. You probably also heard her invoke her Catholicism. Do you take the Speaker at her word? Do you believe her? Do you believe she's telling the truth when she says she does not hate the president and that's not what this is about?
Look, I'll take them at their word when Congresswoman Tlaib said on her very first day in Congress of what she referred to the president, which I wouldn't think anyone would want to refer to them, that she was going to impeach him. Or when Adam Schiff continued to lie to the American public, only get to the point that they are today. Or when he said he was going to send them back to the Golden Throne.
I asked about the Speaker.
I'll take the Speaker at her word, but if she paused for a moment, if she looked at just the facts, she would not have made that determination. If she paused and she actually listened to the hearing yesterday on what a Democrat who did not vote for the president, who has studied the Constitution, who most at any time has been a witness for Democrats or Republicans, based upon his own ability as a scholar, that this is the weakest, the thinnest impeachment in the history of America, that there is no bribery, no extortion, no obstruction of justice, and no abuse of power.
So you don't accept what she said just now?
Actually, Mr.
I think I have a hard time believing her. Yes,
that's not true.
The president himself dismissed the impeachment call when asked if impeachment would be a stain on his own record.
Are you worried, sir, about the stain that impeachment might have on your legacy?
No, not at all.
Mr. President,
it's a hoax.
It's a hoax. It's a big fat hoax. Yes, go ahead.
The charges against Trump, reportedly, the Judiciary Committee could draft and recommend the articles of impeachment to the full House as early as December 12th. Democrats said lawmakers would be working through the weekend to get them written. The charges against Trump could include abuse of power, bribery, obstruction of Congress, and obstruction of justice. If the House passes articles of impeachment as expected, that would lead to a trial in the Senate on whether to convict Trump and remove him from office. Trump's fellow Republicans control the Senate and have shown little support for his removal. Two other presidents were impeached by the House but acquitted by the Senate. In 1998, a Republican-led House passed articles of impeachment against Democratic President Bill Clinton, charges arising from a sexual relationship he had with a White House intern. The other president impeached by the House but left in office by the Senate was Andrew Johnson in 1868, 3 years after the Civil War. Now to this report.
Jesse Lentz with WBAI's Impeachment Watch. You've probably heard by now on this station or elsewhere that this morning Speaker Nancy Pelosi announced that the House of Representatives would begin drafting articles of impeachment against President Trump. The announcement came on the heels of a day of testimony on impeachment in front of the House Judiciary Committee from four law professors, three called by House Democrats and one called by Republicans. While the GOP's witness Jonathan Turley, a professor of public interest law at George Washington University, objected to what he perceives as a rapid timetable for these impeachment proceedings, the three professors called by the Democrats all stated unequivocally that based on the evidence presented so far, they believe President Trump has committed numerous impeachable offenses while in office, according to the criterion set forth by the nation's founders. The Democrats' witnesses also attempted to break down complicated legal subjects in a way the average citizen could understand. For two of them, Pamela Karlan, professor of public interest law at Stanford Law School, and Michael Gerhart, professor of jurisprudence at the University of North Carolina School of Law, they attempted to do this through analogies.
Imagine that you were pulled over for speeding by a police officer, and the officer comes up to the window and says, "You were speeding, but you know, if you give me $20, I'll drop the ticket." And you look in your wallet and you say to the officer, I don't have the $20. The officer says, "Okay, well, just go ahead. Have a nice day." The officer would still be guilty of soliciting a bribe there, even though he ultimately let you off without your paying.
But impeachments are always focusing on somebody who didn't quite get as far as they wanted to. It's as nobody's better than Professor Karlan at hypotheticals, but I'll dare to raise yet another one. Imagine a bank robbery, and the police come, and the person's in the middle of bank robbery, and the person then drops the money and says, I'm going to leave without the money. Everybody understands that's burglary. I'll get it right. Yeah. And in this situation, we've got somebody really caught in the middle of it, and that doesn't excuse the person from the consequences.
However, when Professor Karlan attempted to clarify the difference between a president and a king through wordplay, her statement drew swift condemnation from Republicans on the committee and conservative media.
So kings could do no wrong because the king's word was law. And contrary to what President Trump has said, Article 2 does not give him the power to do anything he wants. And I'll just give you one example that shows you the difference between him and a king, which is the Constitution says there can be no titles of nobility. So while the president can name his son baron, he can't make him a baron.
Professor Karlan apologized for the remark later in the hearing, but added, quote, she wishes the president would apologize for the things that he's done. For the WBAI Evening News, this has been Impeachment Watch. I'm Jesse Lent.
Thanks, Jesse. And you're listening to the news on locally produced and independent WBAI News. I'm Paul DiRienzo. A protest against changes to France's pension system brought parts of the country to a grinding halt on Thursday. Huge crowds of railway workers, teachers, students, hospital workers, and other protesters peacefully marched down Paris's wide boulevard Magenta amid blaring loudspeakers and occasional firecrackers. The festive mood in Paris gave way to a more tense one as the day wore on and sporadic violence broke out, especially near the Place de la République. The government deployed thousands of additional police officers in Paris alone to prepare for potential violence. President Emmanuel Macron was said to be calm and determined in the face of Thursday's strike. France is one of the world's most generous pension systems, but President Emmanuel Macron is pushing ahead to make major changes. Reportedly, the country's pensions are heading to a $19 billion deficit. And in London, musician Eno and public diplomat Anne Wright made statements on behalf of WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange, who's being held in a notorious London prison. He faces possible extradition to the United States, where the journalist faces nearly two centuries in prison for espionage for the release of documents provided by leakers.
We're here today to protest the continued imprisonment of Julian Assange, who's now been running from the law or in solitary confinement for the last 8 years, I think, for being a journalist, essentially. And there aren't many journalists left now. They're an endangered species because newspapers don't need them anymore. They found that you can generate content just by trawling the internet and shuffling the words around, and it doesn't seem to matter very much. Julian Assange is someone who revealed the truth, which was what journalism is supposed to be about, and it's become an increasingly dangerous job, as his case can show. He's now facing 175 years in prison. There are lots of American diplomats who would, or politicians who would really like to see him executed. So please support the campaign to not have him extradited to America, where he won't receive a free trial. There's no chance of that whatsoever. And the only thing he's being held on, and he's being held in solitary confinement in Belmarsh Prison, which is where we put the most dangerous terrorists, what he's being held on is a charge of jumping bail.
I'm here to say to the Home Office, free Julian Assange, because he is a professional journalist. He told us about why the war in Iraq started through WikiLeaks. He told us how the United States and other nations got involved in Afghanistan and Syria. The WikiLeaks has been so important for the world to understand what its government does to it.
Closer to home. As the overdose crisis with opiates and other drugs that kill 70,000 Americans alone every year is turning out to be much more complex in its causes and potential solutions than expected. Sheila Vakaria currently works at the Drug Policy Alliance as the Deputy Director of the Department of Research and Academic Engagement.
This overdose crisis is really being driven by the fact that the drug supply right now is toxic and it's adulterated, and people don't know what they're consuming.
What's the best way to deal with that?
We need a multifaceted approach. Focusing on any single strategy isn't going to get through this, but we're going to need to look at this from a broader perspective, right? Because on the one hand, we need to provide supports to people who are out there and who are using right now and who are on the street and who need to make choices to stay alive and to keep themselves and their loved ones safe. So we advocate for harm reduction policies, policies that acknowledge that some people are going to continue to use drugs and engage in high-risk practices, and how do we help keep them safe and alive? So a big part of our work is expanding access to naloxone or Narcan, which is the overdose reversal drug, and making sure it gets into the hands of community members and people who use drugs and their loved ones, so that when people are using, if they do accidentally overdose, there's someone right there on the spot to reverse that overdose.
The poor person who, for some fault of life, down on their luck because they got given painkillers in the hospital and nobody got them off of it or hooked on this stuff, they're making them out to be a cross between Superman and Super Devil. In reality, they're just our relatives and friends and normal people.
What we're seeing with this overdose crisis is that no group has really been left behind in being touched by this crisis. We're seeing really high rates of overdose deaths in both rural and urban settings. We're seeing people of all classes and all races dying of overdose. And the groups that are dying at the highest rates has shifted over the past decade. And this narrative of people starting with prescription opioids, it only tells part of the story. Unfortunately, it also tells a very regionally specific story, and a story that hasn't really held up very well over the past couple of years, because what we're starting to see is that overdose deaths in big cities are actually starting to go up at a higher rate than those in rural communities. And we're also seeing racial and ethnic minorities, particularly black people in certain cities and states, are actually having higher rates of overdose death than white folks. And so even just over the course of this decade, the narrative of how folks got involved with drugs, which drugs they're overdosing on, and what their stories are has really changed over this past 10 years.
Vakaria says among the changes in the demographics of overdose victims are aging baby boomers.
We also have to acknowledge that different bodies can tolerate different levels of risk, right? And so we can't always just pin it on substances as well. What we're also seeing increasingly is that overdose deaths are going up among the boomer generation and folks that are a bit older. And, you know, these are people who might have been used to using at a certain level and quantity for a number of years. But also, like, as the body gets older and your metabolism changes, you know, sometimes you just can't handle it. And so, you know, giving people strategies for staying safe and staying alive is about learning about the drugs that you're taking, but also kind of really learning about your own limits and thinking of strategies to mitigate risks.
And earlier this week, the city of New York said it would begin to phase out detox centers at 11 city-owned hospitals. Community detox was a victory for community activists in the 1960s, culminating in the Young Lords Party and Black Panther Party seizing and occupying Lincoln Hospital, the hospital serving the South Bronx. Vakaria says the loss of the detox center is actually the result of victories in changing how we treat drug use.
It's not that they're closing detoxes and not offering alternatives. It sounds like they're moving towards a step to actually integrate detox services into the broader healthcare system. What we know is that right now we silo mental health or behavioral health from physical health treatment. And we often send people with drug problems into services or treatment settings that are separate from the greater healthcare system. And what we know is that they're dealing with a lot of the same health issues that folks who don't use drugs are facing. And so on its face right now, it doesn't sound like there's an ending of a service, but it sounds like they're going to be integrating it into the larger system and really exploring options with folks. What we know is that the drug for which most people go to detox is actually alcohol. It's not necessarily something to necessarily be alarmed about or to think it may increase deaths, because it sounds like what they're going to do, from the information that I've been able to see so far, is that they're just going to be able to connect those people into the broader healthcare system. And rather than needing a specified detox department, they'll be integrated into the broader healthcare system. But again, I think there's still more information that I'd like to look into, and we can see how this is going to get rolled out and implemented. But I wouldn't necessarily say that it's a cause for concern just yet. And it may actually be potentially a move to be more integrative in seeing that people with needs who might use drugs or alcohol can be integrated into broader health care.
Greg, I got a couple of stories here. What about the nurses? I'll leave you with this. The nurses, or some nurses, or the nurses union said they're a little worried because, and you mentioned alcohol is the biggest thing, and they come in and sometimes they're non-corpus mentis, or they're violently acting out because they're, you know, whacked out on alcohol, not these other drugs.
Well, I mean, I think that, you know, training staff to be responsive to the needs of any patient is really important, and really acknowledging that when some people are in crisis, whether they're under the influence of drugs or not, you know, staff may have to engage in different precautions. But I wouldn't be so quick to say that people who come in under the influences of drugs or alcohol are necessarily any more unruly or any more challenging than any other patient group. Instead, I'd like to think that, you know, as long as we train staff and ensure to keep their safety a priority, we can actually make treatment settings more sensitive to people who come in with a variety of experiences.
Sheila Vakaria is the Deputy Director of the Department of Research and Academic Engagement at the Drug Policy Alliance. And 1 week before Britain votes in a national election, fractures were emerging Thursday within jittery political parties, unsure how a volatile electorate will judge them. The Brexit Party, led by Nigel Farage, which became UK's, the United Kingdom's top party in European elections earlier this year, saw four senior officials quit, with a broadside accusing Farage of putting Britain's exit from the European Union at risk. Meanwhile, Conservative Prime Minister Boris Johnson and main opposition Labour Party leader Jeremy Corbyn both face criticism criticisms of their moral character. Ian Williams is a blogger with a lot of experience at the UN. He's been following the Brexit fight. He had this to say.
I'm beginning to think a far too large a proportion of the British public think it's their natural fate to be ruled by bumbling upper class cretins.
What is exactly going to happen? What should we be looking out for here?
In my dreams, big Labour majority. In reality, because of the skewed voting, a big accession of new registers, especially from people who are likely to vote Labour. The way the votes are cast is Labour could still come in with significantly fewer votes overall, but get enough to make sure the Conservatives don't have a majority in the Parliament. And then it's a case of negotiations with the other parties, particularly the Scots Nationalists, to see what can be done, whether a coalition is feasible, at the very least to deny Boris Johnson a commanding majority.
What happens next?
He's claiming that he will be able to do a deal and join the European Union, but there's been several court cases and others that he has to go back to Parliament to get that. If he doesn't have a parliamentary majority, then he is really risking a constitutional crisis if he tries to go ahead and leave the European Union without parliamentary majority considering it. There are signs of exasperation every time the Conservatives try to ring a Brexit bell whenever they got up on stage.
What's the Brexit obsession? It's not, it doesn't seem, I mean, is England in the grips of a, as in America, sort of an England first?
You have to remember the former Conservative Prime Minister Cameron wanted to stay in the European Union and agreed to the referendum under pressure from Boris Johnson. Boris Johnson wanted the referendum, not because I don't think he desperately cared one way or the other about whether Britain was in the European Union or not, but simply because he saw it as the vehicle to get himself elected as leader of the Conservative Party. So that part of the plot was successful. And now he's surrounded himself with diehard Brexiteers, as they're called in Britain. And he really doesn't have much wiggle room. He's over and over again said he was going to do it. Keeps right. Trying and never making it.
He can never make it. And so it continues. I mean, the last time we talked also, the outcome was so vague and so unclear.
It's still unclear because just leaving without an agreement would be catastrophic. It would be like sort of a reenaction of warfare without military action with the economic crisis that would follow. Well, what's happened now is that the Conservatives put all of their faith on negotiating a big trade deal with America, which is doubly fallacious. One is that you could trust Donald Trump, who's declared trade war on all of his closest allies, to cut you a particular trade deal. And then Trump, living down to his reputation, made it a condition that everything had to be on the table, including the one thing that is even more of a shibboleth in Britain than Brexit, is the National Health Service. So Trump and his negotiators explicitly were saying, we want you to relax your controls on drug prices. We want to overcharge you for drugs in Britain the same way as we overcharge our citizens are overcharged in America. We want to be able to hive off sections of the National Health Service and privatize them and loot them. And that's been leaking out, and that's become an increasing issue. What Johnson, in the best Trumpian tradition, is to get up and say, we love and revere the National Health Service, and then dodge it whenever the details come up of what he intends to do with it.
Anything like to add?
Jeremy Corbyn's position on Brexit.
It's been said that a lot of what's going on with Brexit and within England is really a last-ditch attempt to keep Jeremy Corbyn from becoming prime minister.
Well, that's very much the case. I mean, it's any port in a storm they're hitting him with. The current farrago is to accuse somebody who spent 40 years fighting Nazis on the streets and going to synagogues and working with Jews and Muslims and everybody else against racism and anti-Semitism. He's now been accused of anti-Semitism. And the documents that the Conservatives and the Likudniks and the New Labour, who all seem to be indistinguishable, are producing, really, it's almost as that they would make the authors of the Protocols of Zion pale in comparison with their ingenuity and their mendacity. The stuff that they're coming out with, it really is repetitive and obsessive.
Ian Williams is author of Deadline Pundit. And that's some of the news for Thursday, December 5th, 2019. The news was produced with Linda Perry and Jesse Lent. Our engineer is Reggie Johnson. From the studios of listener-sponsored, locally produced, and independent WBAI News, I'm Paul DiRienzo.